Britain's spying showdown. Today, Tuesday, December 3rd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Lawmakers in London grill The Guardian's editor about the paper's publishing of Edward Snowden's leaked documents. Also, why many Brits just don't care about the government spying on them.
If it makes us secure, then do it. That's as simple as that. Someone's got to police the world.
And later, why one civilian signed up for the dangerous work of helping to destroy Syria's chemical weapons.
I mean, I've seen the effects of this kind of weapons, and it's easy for me as a father to look at those kids that are affected and realize that these weapons has to go.
Plus, why Icelanders don't want their policemen to carry guns.
That's a part of the great thing of living in a peaceful society. We do not want to change that.
That's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The plan to destroy Syria's chemical weapons is simple on paper. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW as it's known, wants to gather the chemicals in Latakia, Syria's largest port, and then ship the stuff out for destruction at sea. But moving dangerous chemicals through a war zone is never going to be simple, which is why some of the scientists and analysts involved are getting special training. The BBC's Anna Holligan visited one of their training camps.
Where we went in Germany, this is an incredible training facility. The US military actually call it the jewel in their European crown because it's specially modified to act like a real life war zone. And these guys that we're talking about here, the chemical weapons inspectors, have never operated inside a war zone. We're talking about chemical analysts who are used to laboratories. And in the past, the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, they've always gone in after a conflict. So Syria really is an unprecedented mission for them. And that's where the US military comes in, because they have this training base and it allows them to recreate the scenarios that the weapons inspectors might encounter. So one of the commanders on the base told us it's designed to prepare them for what could be the worst day of their lives. So
right.
They go into these mock villages, which are designed to look like Syrian villages, and then they encounter all these kinds of hostilities. So kidnappings, ambushes, illegal checkpoints. It's really quite terrifying. But the idea is that it's safer for them to experience it now before it could happen in Syria.
So, I mean, did you feel like you were actually watching some of these scenarios playing out? And what's the scenario that they're most worried about as they take away these chemical weapons?
The scenario that they're most worried about is being in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's what the chemical weapons inspectors told us. They're worried because they're actually traveling in convoys with the Syrian government representatives. So everywhere they go, they're accompanied by Syrian representatives from the government and also members of the UN. And those are the people that provide their security, but they're also the people who could attract the wrong kind of attention. So it could force them to be indirectly targeted by enemy fire, rebel opposition forces. So that's the thing that they are most concerned about. And the people that we were speaking to on the base in Bavaria, they're actually there now. They've gone in, they started on Monday, and they'll be spending this week visiting the various sites across Syria to verify the presence of these chemical stockpiles.
This team going to Syria, I mean, these are civilians, they're volunteers, they worked in labs, they're not special forces. Why would they put themselves in such a dangerous situation?
It's such a good question. One of the weapons inspectors who I spoke to, he said, well, you know, it's my job and this is what I'm trained for. And I said, I wouldn't do it. I spoke to one of them, and we can't give his name for obvious security reasons, but he explained what had motivated him.
I mean, I've seen pictures on television and the effects of this kind of weapons, and it's easy for me as a father to look at those kids that are affected and realize that these weapons has to go. So if I can do anything about that and help with my skills, I'm more than happy to do it.
Wow, and he's a father.
He is a father. He is a father. He said his girls talk at school to their friends and talk to their family and say, I'm so proud my dad is going in to take the weapons out. He's not using them. And you could see him kind of glowing with pride when he said that. But still, it takes a brave person to do something like this.
So what's the next step then?
Well, the next step is to actually take the weapons out of Syria. And as you probably are aware, a US naval vessel is being brought in. It's being specially modified so it can cope with the neutralization of the chemicals. But then there's another issue. After they've been neutralized on board the US ship, they still have to find somewhere to dispose of them. And still no country has been willing to act as the kind of dumping ground here. So that's the next step.
The BBC's Anna Holligan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here in the US, it's been quiet lately on the NSA surveillance front. Different story in Britain. Today, Alan Rusbridger, editor of the Guardian newspaper, appeared before a parliamentary committee. Lawmakers wanted to know more about the paper's publication of intelligence files leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Rusbridger faced an array of questions, some friendly, others more hostile. This one came from a supporter, MP Keith Vaz.
I love this country. Do you love this country?
We live in a democracy. Most of the people working on this story are British people who have families in this country who love this country. I'm slightly surprised to be asked the question, but yes, we are patriots. And one of the things we are patriotic about is the nature of the democracy and the nature of a free press and the fact that one can in this country discuss and report these things.
Watching the hearing for the New York Times was London bureau chief Stephen Erlanger. He says some questions were even more unusual than that.
The conservatives were tougher. And so, for example, asked him if he had come into the secret of the Enigma machine during World War II, which Britain had gotten one to decode Nazi secret transmissions. You know, would he have printed that kind of information, which Rusbridger dismissed?
I've seen Rusbridger speak before. He comes across slightly professorial. How's he handling this heat?
I think he did very well. I mean, he is very articulate. He does look a little like an absent professor with a sort of mop of hair and big glasses, but he has some backbone. I think he's frustrated a little bit because he feels the Guardian is doing great work and he's not getting a lot of support from other British media or even from too many members of Parliament.
Well, I mean, it's one thing that really jumped out for us, Rusbridger, several times. I mean, contrasting his treatment before these members of Parliament in these hearings with how press freedoms are protected in the U.S. What did he say and what do you make of that comparison?
I think he's correct. In the United States, we have constitutional rights. We have the Bill of Rights. In Britain, as you know, there is no written constitution. And it's much looser. In fact, The Guardian has moved all the material that it got from Snowden to America because it is better protected there, and it is working on that material from its New York offices. And it should be said, sometimes in partnership with my newspaper, the New York Times.
Could you imagine, Steve, this happening in the United States? Like, could journalist Glenn Greenwald, who was a crucial player in the Snowden business, could he be pulled up on Capitol Hill and questioned in the same way?
They could ask him to come. I'm not sure he would come. I'm not sure they'd extradite him. But they could certainly, you know, ask my editor, Jill Abramson, to testify, and it would be up to her to do it or not. This wasn't done under compulsion. As far as I know, they asked him to come, and he came.
And since you're with the New York Times, I mean, were you watching this hearing, listening to it, and kind of almost putting yourself in Rusbridger's shoes, wondering how you might answer some of these questions?
Well, inevitably you do. I mean, I'm not the editor of the New York Times, so I haven't had to make these very difficult decisions. I've talked to people about them, and some people think that what you're printing is a violation of secrets that ought to be kept. Certainly that's the way the British intelligence services feel about what The Guardian has been doing. But these are not easy questions. I mean, there is a balance always to be struck between, you know, what I consider the public's right to know and the government's right to keep certain things secret.
Steve Erlanger, what is your take on the status of press freedom in the U.S. these days? I mean, your colleague in the Washington Bureau, James Risen, has been ordered to testify in the trial of a former CIA official accused of leaking information to him. What are your thoughts?
I worry about it. There's no question that the Obama administration has been going after leakers much harder than even the previous administration. And part of its effort to get leakers, it is trying to compel testimony from people they've leaked to, like Jim Risen. And Jim Risen's refusal so far to testify has set him on a collision course with the courts.
Stephen Erlanger, the London bureau chief of the New York Times, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now to what the British public makes of all this. The documents leaked by Edward Snowden have revealed that the NSA worked very closely with British intelligence agencies. That included gathering data on British citizens. Now, that kind of surveillance has provoked outrage here and in many other nations, but the British don't seem as upset, as Christopher Worth reports from London.
The U.S. isn't the only country that spies on its own citizens. Earlier this year, the U.K.'s Guardian newspaper uncovered Tempora. It's a secret program that enables Britain to sift through vast amounts of phone and internet data by tapping into the fiber optic cables that route through the U.K. and out to most of the world. But ask your average British citizen whether he minds being spied on by his own government, and you'll likely get a response like this.
Doesn't bother you at all?
No.
Why not?
Because someone's got to police the world.
I met Vince Fay outside a busy train station in London, and he says he accepts a loss of privacy.
If it makes us secure, then do it. That's as simple as that. There's a bigger world out there, and they've got to find terrorists, people who are going to cause harm. So carry on spying.
There's a curious situation here where Americans are outraged to discover they are being spied on and watched, and Britons give a kind of polite shrug of the shoulders, and so what?
Jonathan Friedland is a columnist for The Guardian, which has published much of the Snowden revelations. He points to a recent opinion poll that shows only 19% of Britons believe UK intelligence agencies have too much power. 64% thought they either had just the right amount or not enough. And Friedland says there are a number of reasons for Britain's blasé attitude. For one, the British have grown rather used to the idea that the government can watch their every move. Take the train station Vince Fay and I are standing in. Would you mind just counting the number of security cameras that you see?
There's about 14, 16.
All in this one?
All in this one area. Within a mile, there's got to be thousands.
Actually, it's tough to pin down just how many surveillance cameras there are in Britain. Nick Pickles of Big Brother Watch, a civil liberties and privacy watchdog, estimates as many as 4 million in this country of just over 60 million people.
There's a huge number of cameras, however you look at it, in a way that few people from Europe or the US would recognize as being a part of a healthy democratic society.
And Pickles says there's another reason for Britain's indifference. That's right, good old 007.
Who are you?
My name is Bond. James Bond.
Pickles is not just making this up. Research by the pollster YouGov and Cambridge University shows Ian Fleming's fictional spy has had a big influence on what people think being a spy is all about. As a result, Pickles says, the British inherently trust their spy agencies.
So you get this weird fictional impression of how the intelligence world operates. And that's a really dangerous problem because people may think that James Bond breaks the rules and bends the rules sometimes, but he's only doing it to catch the bad guys. And people don't want to stop James Bond doing his job.
Andy says the James Bond problem is hampering a deeper public debate about what Britain's intelligence agencies get up to. But Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian says the biggest reason the British aren't up in arms over government spying? The Queen of England.
My lords and members of the House of Commons.
The extent to which Britain is still a monarchical country is very relevant.
My government's legislative program.
Friedland says the big difference between Britain and America is that in the United States,
the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." Power in Britain does not belong, even formally, to the people, which means that power flows from the people at the top, the government, and it flows downward to the people at the bottom, that Britons are still, officially even, subjects rather than citizens.
And subjects, he says, are more apt to do as they're told and shrug their shoulders at being spied on. For The World, I'm Christopher Worth, London.
Still ahead, one up in Gilligan, we meet the man they're calling the first ever web Robinson Crusoe on The World from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For all you coffee drinkers out there, pay close attention to this story. A fungus is eating away at coffee trees in Central and South America. The disease is called leaf rust, or la roya in Spanish. It's not a new problem, but a warmer, wetter climate is making this new outbreak the worst in a generation. Some 2 million people work in the coffee industry, from Guatemala to Peru. 400,000 of them are now out of a job, and things could get worse. But some people here in New England are working to prevent that. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
Willie Foote is not your typical banker. He's tuning up his guitar in his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The guitar in Mexico years ago, and it kind of lies.
Foote wanted to play me a popular Latin American folk song about coffee. He rewrote the lyrics. The song is now about the fungus impacting coffee, with lines in banker speak.
May the coffee leaf rust die in the fields, thanks to a downpour of support and credit from buyers paying special premium prices.
Right about then, I was thinking, this is going to be uncomfortable. I was wrong.
Ojalá que muera la roya en el campo, que caiga un aguacero de apoyo y crédito.
Hard to believe that a song about a fungus and banking could actually be quite engaging.
De pronto la renovación ya floreció. Oh, 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 oh. Ojalá que muera la roya.
Foote traded in his power suit on Wall Street for a guitar, jeans, and a sweater vest in the 1990s and started the nonprofit investment firm Root Capital. Since then, his organization has loaned nearly $500 million to small agricultural businesses throughout the developing world. Foote says their loans go to farmers operating in the so-called missing middle.
They're too large for microfinance, like the $300 loan to the street vendor or the shoe cobbler, and still too small, too risky, too remote for traditional banks.
Folks like Central American coffee farmers suffering from leaf rust.
The loans will be used to replace diseased coffee trees with a new high-quality, rust-resistant variety.
Root Capital isn't the only one fighting this scourge thousands of miles away. Small coffee houses are also taking action to battle leaf rust.
What we're doing now is we're roasting coffee.
Charlie Fishbein has been roasting beans and serving up cups at his shop, The Coffee Exchange, in Providence, Rhode Island, for 3 decades. Fishbein offers his customers choices of beans from 30 nations.
Our customers have, over the years, become so sophisticated about what coffee tastes better for them. They can tell the difference between coffee from Guatemala and coffee from Ethiopia.
Almost three-quarters of Fishbein's beans come from Central America. He worries that his business could be devastated if his customers have fewer options. But he knows his problems are nothing compared with those faced by Central American farmers he buys from.
For coffee farmers who are dealing with this rust crisis, if they can't sell the coffee, they don't have coffee to sell, they don't eat.
Fishbein and 22 other small roasters in the U.S. and Canada formed a group called Cooperative Coffees. They work closely with small-scale organic farmers to help meet fair trade standards, things like better wages and working conditions. And now, the roasters are fighting leaf rust. Fishbein says the North American roasters have recently tacked on an extra 5 cents per pound of coffee. In just a few months, these nickels have added up to $50,000 for Central American farmers to battle leaf rust, or La Roya.
La Roya happens every year, almost every year, not to this extent and not to at this altitude. It means that if we don't catch it now and do something about it for the next crop, we could be in serious danger of losing a lot of coffee. This is a serious problem.
If the disease outbreak does get worse, it's going to take a lot more money from coffee sellers here up north, not just small coffee houses. The big guys are well aware. Starbucks recently bought a coffee farm in Costa Rica to study leaf rust. Green Mountain Coffee in Vermont is teaming up with Root Capital in Cambridge to raise $10 million to loan to farmers. They're also teaching them new practices to battle the impacts of a warming climate. Small-scale coffee farmers will need those tools. The growing techniques they've used for generations may no longer be enough. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
A new cozy coffee shop can be a sign that a neighborhood is changing for the better. But sometimes when a rundown neighborhood starts gentrifying, there's friction, too. Take the Hochelaga Maisonneuve neighborhood in Montreal, in Canada. It's long had a reputation as a rough part of the city. Now, where there used to be bikers, addicts, and prostitutes, there are hip bars and restaurants. That change has not been smooth, though. In fact, recently, it's been kind of violent. A number of those fine dining establishments and trendy bars have been targeted by vandals. Mathieu Ménard is the owner of Le Chasseur, a restaurant that was targeted recently.
My friend said to me, we are attacked. So I just came at the restaurant and I saw that my windows just was broken. So I just see a hammer inside of my restaurant. So.
So somebody threw a hammer into the window?
Yeah, because it's just trying to throw some bricks, but the bricks just doesn't work. So just try it with a hammer.
And I gather your restaurant wasn't the only one that got hit by vandals.
No, we have four.
Who did this? I mean, did anybody or any group claim responsibility?
I don't know who they are. I just know I am the victim of what? Of a change, of an evolution of the neighborhood. It's not my fault. So I don't know who did this, but maybe the police will catch him.
Wasn't there a letter attached to the bricks or this hammer?
Not at my restaurant. The other one to see a letter around the bricks. But,
and what did those letters say?
Say you're not in security, you're not at your place, and we will catch you, a small bourgeois.
Mathieu, why did you choose to open a business in this neighborhood?
Because I live here since 10 years. Every time I want to drink a beer or eat some good food, I was to just go at the other neighborhood up the street. One day I just wake up and I said, hey, I will open a restaurant, a good restaurant in Hochelaga, because a lot of people like me just have to go away to eat fine and drink good cocktails and something like that. So I just trying to open it, and it's a success. So
do you understand the hard feelings among people who used to live in this neighborhood and now are feeling squeezed out by high rents and places like your restaurant that they probably can't afford?
Maybe you some people doesn't have the money to came at my restaurant, and it's okay. But in Hochelaga, you have a lot of fast food or other restaurants. Maybe they can afford it. Don't. I'm not sure. I am the guy who provoke or change the situation in Hochelaga. I'm not the good target for sure.
Mathieu, what are you going to do to cope with the problem aside from getting a hammer-proof window?
I'm doing nothing. I just continue to make great food, continue to serve clients. It's okay, you want to throw a brick in my windows? Okay, let's go. And we will change the windows. And some customers came at my restaurant last week and said, you know what, Mathieu? We are here because we know you have trouble, and just please stay. Stay and continue, because you are the good faces of the neighborhood, and we want you. So I receive more than affection when this situation just came.
Mathieu Ménard, the owner of Le Chasseur in the Montreal neighborhood of Hochelaga Maisonneuve. Thanks very much and the best of luck.
Thank you.
This is PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the difficult and divisive Adolf Sachs.
This dynamic, prolific, dangerous Belgian that had arrived in Paris split up the musical world in France between pros and cons.
The tale of the man who invented the saxophone ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. If you're studying Mandarin, you know it's not an easy language to learn. The meaning of words can change significantly based on super subtle variations of tone and context. And before you can read a simple newspaper article, you have to master thousands of Chinese characters. And here's some more bad news if you're a Mandarin speaker wannabe. Even if you speak Mandarin fluently, you may not be able to communicate with nearly a third of the people living in China. Ruth Morris explains.
Listen to this. It's a speech by Mao Zedong.
Mao did not speak clear Mandarin. The founding father of the People's Republic of China spoke with such a pronounced regional accent that many Chinese had a hard time understanding him. To this day, hundreds of millions of Chinese speak dialects, some call them separate languages, that are so far apart, they're mutually unintelligible.
Just like eating the dinner. In Mandarin, we call it 吃饭, but in Chongming language, we call it 吃饭.
This is Gu Hangyu, a student who took me to his native Chongming Island. It's just 45 minutes' drive from the center of shiny, bustling Shanghai. But linguistically, it's a much longer trip. Gu's grandmother, Wang Yufeng, chops down sugarcane for us to chew on. She's a farmer, and her life has been hard. Corn cobs fuel her stove, and hand-picked cotton fills her comforter. In winter, she heats her home with the energy from a car battery. As her husband pops beans out of dried husks, Wang tells us she doesn't speak Mandarin and she doesn't need to. With her grandson translating, Wang tells me all her neighbors speak the Chongming dialect, the bus driver speaks it, and everyone at the market speaks it too. But Gu, the grandson, is less matter of fact. He's worried his native dialect might fade.
I'm proud of Chongming because I think it's a beautiful town and the people in Chongming are friendly. If I speak Chongming native language, and you could figure that I am Chongmingese.
I think some dialects, especially the small dialects, could be disappeared in the near future.
Yo Rijie is a linguist at Fudan University. It's a testament to today's mobility and migration in China that his family speaks four dialects, yet his son and his parents don't have a single dialect in common. They can't communicate, and that's not uncommon here.
My parents cannot speak Mandarin. They just speak the Wenzhou dialect.
Yo says for all intents and purposes, China's 10 or so dialect groups should be treated as completely separate languages. Think of the difference between Italian and Spanish. Here's Professor Yo telling me in Mandarin that when he was 18, he went to university in Hangzhou. Then he says exactly the same thing in Hangzhou dialect. In Mandarin,
我在16岁的时候到杭州上大学.
In the Hangzhou dialect,
16岁时光到杭州读大学.
Many Chinese minorities have their own languages, like Uyghur, Mongolian, and Tibetan. Professor Yo says Mandarin has also lagged in rural areas because of poor schooling. If you want to buy a necklace in Xinjiang or a cell phone in parts of southern China, you might get further in English than in Mandarin. On Chongming Island, I asked Gu's grandmother if she's ever considered learning Mandarin.
She said
that it's hard for older people like her to study Mandarin and it's useless for them, but it's useful for the young people like me.
At 68, Gu's grandmother says she's confident the Chongming dialect will outlast her. But if her dialect is lost and she's still alive, at that time, she says, she will leave the world.
She will leave the world. She will die at that time.
For The World, I'm Ruth Morris, Chongming Island, China.
Tomorrow we'll hear about another Chinese language. Manchu was the official language during the Qing Dynasty. Today it's nearly extinct. We have more stories on the languages of China at pri.org/language. Bell rings, class period ends, and let's talk math, science, and reading now. Those are the three subjects covered by the PISA test. PISA is the Program for International Student Achievement, and the PISA test is a standardized test ranking 15-year-olds around the globe. The latest scores were announced today, and American students got about a C+. They scored in the middle of the developed world in reading and science, but lagged behind in math. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Today she was moderating a conference in Washington where the PISA test results were announced.
I was actually very encouraged and surprised to see the number of countries that are now performing at the very top of the world, in the top tier, that also have significant levels of child poverty, lots of problems. They are not these kind of, you know, Nordic utopia of Finland that you hear about. These are places like Poland, which has a 16% child poverty rate. Vietnam, which took the test for the first time, scored right at the top of the world. Vietnam has crushing levels of child poverty. So even though American teenagers did below average for the developed world in math and at average in reading and science, which is about the same as we've always done since the test started in 2000, this is actually really encouraging for us because in some ways, learning from these countries is more relevant than learning from a place like Finland or Korea. These are countries that have lots of challenges that are similar to those of the United States, and they are proving that this is possible.
I mean, the U.S. does seem to lag behind other countries, but it's not so much a lag as it is kind of a plateau at this point. But I guess what I assume a lot of people here in the U.S. want to know is how do we turn that from a plateau to a spike that's going up?
One thing that all the countries that have improved have done is that they, among other things, have agreed on a set of higher standards for what kids should know, a more coherent sort of plan that everybody gets behind for where you're headed. Now, what's interesting about that is that this is exactly what the Common Core State Standards are supposed to do. These are a new set of standards that were adopted by 46 states in the U.S. But now, of course, there's big fights happening in many, many states about whether to stick with these standards, a lot of concern about whether it's too standardized or whether the federal government's involved. And it's interesting because if we were to continue down that path, that is something that at least the OECD, which produces the PISA report, feels very strongly would lead to significant gains for American teenagers, because the idea is to really focus on fewer, more rigorous standards for what kids should know. So that's one thing that these countries have done.
As your own research shows, Amanda, Poland is flexing its public education achievement muscle. What are they doing?
I was amazed to see how high Poland scored in these rankings. There are more Polish teenagers, percentage-wise, performing at the advanced level in math than there are in Finland. I did not expect them to reach quite those heights so fast. They went from below average for the developed world in 2000, way below the U.S., to well above the U.S. and above the average in 2012. They did a bunch of reforms in 1999-2000. The thing, though, that seemed to make the most difference for Poland, according to their own research, was that they delayed their separation of students by ability. So most countries, including the U.S., at some point, divide students into groups. You know, the kids who are headed to university and the kids who maybe are headed to community college or vocational school or no college at all. So what you see all around the world is the longer you keep kids together in an academic setting, the better on average all kids do, including the ones who are headed for the university anyway, which is kind of counterintuitive. You know, we sort of assume that, you know, at some point it'd be easier to teach these kids if you group them by ability into different classes. But you find the opposite is true in real life.
You're actually at the museum in Washington, D.C., where the PISA results were announced, and you moderated a panel with the U.S. Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. When you spoke with him about the U.S. results on the PISA survey, what did he have to say?
He called the new results a picture of education stagnation for the United States, which I think is accurate. He also said that, you know, he felt like there are things that we could do that other countries have done that we know would yield returns, like investing more in pre-K education. Even by age 15, the kids who have gone through some kind of early childhood education, even for a year or two, seem to do better on a sophisticated test of critical thinking in math, reading, and science.
Journalist Amanda Ripley, she's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Thanks very much for unpacking these test results for us, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a headline you won't read every day in Iceland. Iceland police shoot man dead. In fact, that's the first time the headline has been written since Iceland became a republic in 1944. Why? Well, that's the obvious question. Thora Arnarsdottir is a senior reporter at RUV, the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service. So we know that a man in the capital Reykjavik was shot by police yesterday, Thora. Describe, first of all, what happened. Why did the police respond to this incident?
Well, as it turns out, this man, a 59-year-old, had severe psychiatric problems for many years. He had been in and out of hospitals. He had paranoia. And the neighbors started hearing shots and obviously called the police, which arrived. So they decide to rush in and he shoots at the police officers. And they responded.
I guess the investigation must now be looking at this 59-year-old victim as well as the policeman looking into their own ranks and what they did.
Definitely. The nation was in shock. This does not happen in our country. I mean, everyone had their phones up and they were recording, they were shouting, screaming, and every other person would say, this is like an American film. What is going on?
An American film.
An American film, exactly, yes.
I got to say, you sound pretty shook up yourself, Thora, and you're a reporter.
Absolutely. Also because, I mean, there are a lot of questions still. Why didn't they try to negotiate? Why didn't they call someone from his family just to know who is this? Why is he acting like this? So there are a lot of questions there. We would obviously not want our police force to have shot a man if it wasn't absolutely, absolutely necessary, because they don't carry weapons.
Why not?
Because we don't want them to. The nation doesn't want our police force to carry weapons. It's threatening. It's dangerous. That's just how it is. But obviously, we must be ready to face difficult situations. So there is a special force that can be called upon when something happens, but it has never, ever come to this.
One interesting thing, Thor, is that Iceland ranks per capita for gun possession 15th in the world. So What is going on there that there are a lot of guns, but violent crime is low?
First and foremost, it's culture. Guns are used to go hunting as a sport, but you never see a gun. So it's just not a part of our culture yet. I mean, we've been fighting international crime as well. We have part of the Eastern European mafia stepping into Iceland in drug trafficking. But I mean, you don't see anyone carry a weapon.
Thora, you said earlier just how shocked the nation of Iceland is by this incident yesterday. One thing that struck a lot of people here is that police, they actually apologized to the man's family. How are police themselves dealing with this?
They're getting counseling. And I think actually it's respectful of the police to apologize to the victim's family, because obviously they're sorry. No one wants to take another person's life. Not when you're a policeman and not in any other circumstances.
I mean, the fact that the neighbors next to this man, this victim yesterday, were saying, wow, this is like an American movie. Is there a feeling in Iceland that this piece that you've been living through is about to change?
I don't know. There is always a first. One thinks, will this be slowly normalized? I really hope that it won't. A part of the great thing about living in this country is that you can enter parliament and the only thing that they ask you to do is to turn off your phone so you won't disturb the parliamentarians while they're talking. Mm. I mean, we do not have armed guards following our prime minister or president. That's a part of the great thing of living in a peaceful society. We do not want to change that.
Thora Arnarsdottir, senior reporter at the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service, RUV. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Marco.
A tale from another island now. French businessman Gauthier Tout-le-Monde wanted to test his theory that people can telecommute from just about anywhere. So,
just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
No shipwreck this time. Tout-le-Monde willingly traveled to a desert isle in Indonesia, and he spent 40 days living in a tent there.
No phone, no lights,
no motor car, not a single luxury. Like Robinson Crusoe, it's primitive as can be.
Unlike Gilligan, Tout-le-Monde did have a few luxuries. He used solar panels, a windmill, and two satellite phones to go online and stay connected with his publishing company back in Paris. He says he succeeded in keeping the business running, but he wants us to know it was not a cakewalk.
It was not so easy to get an internet connection and for me to live in a very poor condition, as I was at the rainy season in Indonesia. So I got big storm every day. And to get the internet connection, I was obliged to be facing the ocean. And when it's raining, it's not so easy.
He also admits that fishing for food wasn't his forte, and that after a while, he missed saying bonjour to colleagues every morning. You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A clear message today from Vice President Joe Biden to China.
We, the United States, are deeply concerned by the attempt to unilaterally change the status quo in the East China Sea.
Biden was referring to China's declaration of a new air defense zone over a group of disputed islands. The declaration has raised tensions with Japan, where Biden was visiting today. The U.S. is committed by treaty to defend Japanese security. Today, Biden reaffirmed that commitment and added a warning.
This action has raised regional tensions and increased the risk of accidents and miscalculation.
I think the vice president is absolutely correct.
That's retired Navy Admiral Mike McDevitt. He used to command a carrier battle group. He's also written extensively on China's push for influence in the seas around Asia as a senior analyst at CNA, a nonprofit research organization in Alexandria, Virginia.
Because China's air defense information zone overlaps almost identically with Japan's, that means that you could potentially have Japanese F-15s launched to identify an airplane coming from China, and China in turn could launch its own interceptors to go up to intercept the Japanese interceptors. So the possibility of an accident is very high, or a misjudgment. So that's, I think, what everybody's concerned about.
How dangerous do you think it could get? I mean, no one wants war, but could some low-level officer do something silly?
There is always that possibility. I don't think it will happen, but you can't rule it out. Clearly, by establishing this ADIZ zone, China overlapping Japan, China is demonstrating that they have a high tolerance for risk, because by doing this, they have increased the risk of an accident. And that's, I think, the thing that has everybody very concerned. This is, to a degree, it's like throwing gasoline on the fire. The situation is, between Japan and China over these islands is already difficult enough. To layer this on top of it is not very helpful.
How concerned are you personally?
I guess I would be moderately concerned. I think that the command and control in Japan and in China is such that people will be very responsible in making sure an accident doesn't happen. But accidents are, by definition, things that nobody planned to have take place, and so you can't rule it out.
What do these islands represent? I mean, how close have you actually gotten to them?
Many years ago, I've steamed by them. Didn't pay much attention at the time. They were uninhabited. And they have no indigenous population waiting to return or anything like that. The islands are a combination of both symbolic in terms of sovereignty, but more importantly, possession of the islands can potentially create an economic exclusive zone, which allows the owning state to be able to claim the resources, the fish and any oil or gas that's below the seabed.
Retired U.S. Navy Admiral Mike McDevitt, also a senior analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis. Thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, listen up. A dangerous Belgian, the devil's horn, and a listener request. I feel like I'm setting up the amazing Karnak here. But no, those are the key ingredients for this week's Sideways Glance, our regular spot for those stories from across the globe that make us do a double take. Clark Boyd, take it away.
Better music. That's the message listener Pat White sent to us recently when we asked what you'd like to hear more of on our show. On November 6th, you missed the birthday of the inventor of the saxophone, Pat wrote. Right, Pat. Well, I just happen to have lived in Belgium for a while, so it looks like I get to bring you this Sideways Glance at Adolf Sax and his most famous creation. Antoine Joseph Sax was born in Dinant, Belgium, in November of 1814. No one's quite sure why people started calling him Adolf. Anyway, his family moved to Brussels when he was only a few months old. Sax's father was a carpenter and a maker of musical instruments. And from a young age, Sax learned the craft at his father's side.
Little Adolf had the opportunity to learn all about it in this workshop, and he was really great at it. He started out on his own instrument, the clarinet, more or less when he was 14 or 15 years old.
That's Jo Santi of the Museum of Musical Instruments in Brussels. Santi says the talented and extremely entrepreneurial Sax lit out for Paris in the early 1840s.
His aim was nothing short of introducing a whole new range of instruments for the French army, which is, of course, a huge market.
Sax wasted no time. He borrowed some money, built his own workshop, and started making a range of what he called sax horns. These would later become famous as things like the flugelhorn and the bass tuba. And then, in 1846, he unveiled a patent for a special something he'd been working on for a few years, a saxophone, part clarinet, part older brass instrument called an ophicleide.
The first patent shows the mouthpiece of a clarinet, a detailed drawing of an ophicleide, and then the detailed drawing of the baritone saxophone with, next to it, rough sketches of the smaller versions up until the soprano.
Yeah, that's an early composition for six saxophones. Sounds great, right? Well, one problem selling the sax sound was Sax himself, who was a difficult personality.
With Adolf Sax, he was so controversial. You were either for him or you were against him. This dynamic, prolific, dangerous Belgian that had arrived in Paris split up the musical world in France between pros and cons.
And so Sax made fortunes and lost them. He went bankrupt three times fighting lawsuits brought by rivals. Rivals who, when Sax's 10-year patent ran out on the saxophone, started making their own versions. The saxophone enjoyed success in chamber music, orchestras, but above all, in military bands. Adolf Sax died in 1894 and is buried in Paris. His most famous creation eventually made its way to America. And the rest, as any jazz lover will tell you, is history.
It was love at first sight, really, between jazz musicians and the saxophone. They play like they would sing it. And the saxophone is a very, very good instrument to do that. You can cry and talk and weep and shout on a saxophone like you do with your voice.
Jo Santi says Adolf Sax will be in the spotlight next year. It's the 200th anniversary of his birth. In Brussels, the Museum of Musical Instruments will host a special exhibit on Sax and all of his musical instruments. And in his hometown of Dinan, a major international saxophone competition will take place. Plenty of time for listener Pat White to book a ticket. I recommend the bar next to the Citadel in Dinan. Great views of the Meuse River. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
You must have a favorite thing worthy of a sideways glance, so stop by PRI.org and tell us about it, or tweet it using the hashtag YourWorld. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.